Welcome to the Security Analysis Podcast. This podcast explores investment strategies, economics, personal finance, and stock analysis. It features real conversations and analysis to inform, educate, and entertain. Note that nothing in this podcast is investment advice, and it is for entertainment and discussion purposes only. Do your own due diligence before making any investment. Now, on to the show.
Today I'm speaking with Gautam Baid. He's a CFA and he's currently the managing partner of the Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund, a Delaware-based investment partnership which is available to accredited investors in the United States. The fund is actually modeled after the original Buffett partnership fee structure, and it invests in listed Indian equities with a long-term fundamental value-oriented approach. He is also the author of the international bestseller on value investing, The Joys of Compounding. In 2018 and 2019, he was profiled in Morningstar's Learn from the Masters series. Today, we're going to discuss his investing philosophy and background, along with his new book, The Making of a Value Investor, which is an investment journal summarizing his experience during the bear market of 2018 through 2020. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. It's an honor to have you here. So first question I always ask everybody, how did you first get interested in investing?
So just like most investors in the stock market, my journey also started in a very similar way. It was basically I was pulled or attracted into the stock market during the final euphoric phase of a multi-year bull market. In my case, it was the 2003 to 2007 bull market in India. I still remember I had purchased a mutual fund called Reliance Power Sector Mutual Fund in December 2007 and a stock named Ispat Steel in January 2008 because both these investments belong to the hot and fancied sectors of power and steel at that particular time. And I bought these investments without paying any attention to their valuations or underlying business model or the sustainability of their growth. And I eventually paid the price. Both those investments crashed 70 to 80% over the next 18 months. And I'd successfully gained entry into the stock markets by paying my tuition fees. Despite this initial setback, my interest and enthusiasm about investing in the public markets always remained very high throughout the first 7 years of my professional career. I had begun my job career with Citibank in their Mumbai, India office as an investment banking analyst, where I worked for 3 years. And from there on, I joined Deutsche Bank as a senior analyst in their investment banking team, where I'd worked for 4 years in their India, London, and Hong Kong offices. But I was not really having that job satisfaction despite earning a good salary income, because over a period of time, you realize that it is not really money that is driving you. It is, you know, the job satisfaction, the intellectual process, you know, which you deploy on a daily basis, that is what really actually makes you happy in a sustainable way. And I thought we just have this one short life to live our dreams. And I did not want to waste any further time doing something that I was not truly passionate about. So I quit that investment banking field. And I was so keen for a career shift to the public market side that I relocated to the US in May 2015 without any job in hand. One of my relatives who lives in the US, he sponsored my green card. So I was under the impression that since I'm a CFA charter holder, I will easily get a stock market job, at least at the basic entry level, and then work my way up from there. But as you know, life is not a bed of roses for those trying to carve their own destiny. I got rejected in the first 3 stock market job interviews in the first 6 months of coming to the US. But I did not give up because I was very firm and adamant that I'm not going to go back to my previous field of investment banking, where the presence of perverse incentives always led to incentive cost bias and did not suit my personal nature. So in order to, at the same time, whatever money I had brought with me from India to take care of my living expenses, that was about to run out. So to sustain myself in this country, I took up a minimum wage job as a front desk clerk at a hotel in San Francisco, where I worked for 15 months during the graveyard shift. Just for those who are uninitiated with this term, the graveyard shift basically refers to that shift which runs from 11 p.m. at night to 7 a.m. in the morning. And even though it was a very big challenge for me, intellectually, culturally, physically, and emotionally, today in hindsight, I highly value those days of my life because for the first time since the beginning of my busy investment banking career, I finally got time for myself to read and learn. The pace of work at the hotel from late night to early morning was pretty slow, and I made full use of the free time to read every single blog article published on blogs like MacroCap Club, BaseItInvesting.com, FundoProfessor.com, SafalNiveshak.com, among others. And the passionate pursuit of lifelong learning had finally begun. Now, at this particular point, I would like to highlight to you the significance and the power of passion. There's an entire chapter dedicated to this topic in the Joys of Compounding, and I want to share why this is such a powerful construct in life in general. I remember during those 15 months at the hotel job, every night I used to fill up a minimum of 3 stock market job applications online. And if you just do the basic math, over those 15 months, I'd applied to more than 1,300 stock market jobs in the US. You know, every time we take out the time to fill out the application, attach a resume, and click on the submit button, there is so much hope attached behind every single submission. To face rejections more than 1,300 times and still keep on going, it's only and only humanly possible if you're absolutely fanatic about what you want to do in life, if you're absolutely passionate and dedicated about what you want, about the career path that you want to pursue. And compounding will bestow its magic and benefits upon you only after testing your patience and conviction to the fullest. And that is exactly what happened with me as well. During late, during November 2016, during one fine night in the hotel, during the course of my routine online job search, I randomly clicked on the quick apply button on a job application on LinkedIn. And wonder of wonders, I was shortlisted for the interview, and that too for a senior role in an investment firm, even though I had zero formal stock market job experience. And this was the phase in my life during which I was about to realize the power of compounding knowledge in action. You see, all those hundreds of hours spent over the previous 15 months at the hotel job, educating myself on investing through those blog articles and internet content, had now built a strong intellectual foundation for me in investing. And this time, I was able to excel in all the 3 rounds of my job interview, and I was offered the designation of portfolio manager of global equity strategy with Summit Global Investments in Salt Lake City, Utah. And it was like a dream come true for me, because never in my wildest dreams had I ever imagined that I'll straight away land the job of a portfolio manager. I thought I'll start as a junior analyst, then work my way up to an analyst, then to a senior analyst, then to assistant portfolio manager, and finally reach the designation of portfolio manager after 13, 14 years. But this is what sheer persistence can actually achieve for you in life. So I highly encourage everyone never to give up. Never, give up, because you never know when you're going to make it big. So just keep on going. Like Thomas Edison has taught us that most of life's big failures are those people who did not realize how close they were to success before they gave up. So never give up. So I worked in that particular job for the next 4.5 years. I lived a very frugal lifestyle, saved a lot of money. I used to invest that money into the Indian stock market and earn very good returns on it. And by July 2021, I was financially independent enough to quit my corporate job career and venture out on my own. So over the next 12 months, I worked on getting the regulatory licenses and setting up a team in place to launch Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund. This is a Delaware-based investment partnership modeled after the Buffett partnership fee structure, and it is available to accredited investors in the US. The fund went live on 3rd October 2022, and it has delivered 41.5% returns in the first 16 months after performance fees. So the start has been good, and the reason for that is that I deliberately chose to launch the fund during, a period of maximum pessimism in late 2022. So that time you get the benefit of, lower valuations as well. So my advice I always give to emerging managers is try always endeavor to launch your investment management career during a bear market. It's more difficult to attract capital in a bear market, but if you're doing this as a practice, not as a business, if you're actually wanting to practice your craft as a value investor in a fund manager role, then over time, as you deliver performance and build your track record, the AUM growth will, pick up over time. So focus on building a track record. That is the most important thing which you need to focus on. So that was a brief about my journey. And you also asked about, how I got interested in the investing field and I learned about value investing. So first, I got attracted in late 2007 into the markets, but it was only after late 2013 when I came across, the works of Buffett, Munger, Phil Fisher, Peter Lynch, Howard Marks, etc., that I begin to educate myself on the value investing discipline. And those learnings have served me very well till date.
That's an incredibly inspirational story. Yeah, you had a quote in the book, and I think you've really embodied this, where you say, this is from your first book, you said, "We have two lives, and the second one begins when we realize we only have one." And I think you've, based on your story, you really live that way.
That's true. That's true. I think, I'm very fortunate and blessed that I've discovered my passion in life rather than sleepwalking through it like most people do. Because we just get so much entangled in the norms of society that this is how you have to behave, this is how you have to live your life. But like Naval Ravikant has taught us, life is a single player game. You're responsible for your own actions and you're responsible for your own happiness. So do what makes you happy and life will never go wrong.
That's very true. And most people do sleepwalk through life, which is pretty tragic. They just kind of go through the motions and don't really think through all the decisions that they're making.
That's true. Unfortunate, but I hope both my books are able to, just be a guiding light for my readers and, help them just embark on the right path and live a very fulfilling life, because life will be over before you know it. Life is too short. And like Seneca has taught us that, actually life is not too short. It's basically how we live it. Basically that's what makes life really meaningful.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, what are the chief ideas behind your investment philosophy? Like, if you were to break it down in simple terms, what would you say your investment philosophy is?
So Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund's investment philosophy, the investment framework, is built on two key pillars: variant perception and long-term structural trends. Let's talk about variant perception first. Variant perception refers to situations where you get return on capital employed, ROC expansion, coupled with earnings growth, and you get valuation re-rating, and this is how you get multi-baggers. And variant perception comes from having a differentiated view on the short to medium term trajectory of a business. And there are multiple triggers for variant perception. Number one, product mix change into a higher margin category. Because in these cases, your profit growth outpaces your revenue growth. Number two, operating leverage. This can come from having high unutilized capacity just at the beginning of an industry upcycle. Number three, industry cycle shift. So in the Indian market, for example, since middle of 2020, the residential real estate cycle has turned around after more than a decade, and you have had many multi-baggers coming from the building material space in India in the last 3.5 years. Number four, regulatory change. So positive regulatory change can often act as a tailwind for industries. As an example, in March 2022, the Reserve Bank of India, the central bank in India, announced new guidelines for the microfinance industry, because of which the addressable market size for these companies expanded. And since that particular date, in the last 2 years, you have had many multi-baggers coming from the microfinance listed players. Number five, working capital improvement. Because working capital is a part of capital employed, if you're able to negotiate better terms of trade with your customers and suppliers, then your working capital days go down, your working capital requirements go down. Therefore, capital employed goes down and return on capital employed ROC goes up, and you get valuation re-rating. Number six, deleveraging. This is pretty straightforward. As debt comes down, interest costs go down, net profit goes up, market cap goes up. And because debt is a part of capital employed, as debt goes down, your ROC goes up, and you get valuation re-rating. Number seven, improvement in asset turns. So this information you can get from management on conference calls. You can ask them what is the expected turnover on the new fixed asset capacity. And there are two sources for ROC expansion. One is margin improvement, and second is improvement in asset turns. And between the two, I prefer the latter because higher margins tend to attract competition. The eighth trigger for variant perception is corporate actions like spin-offs, merger arbitrage, promoter or management change, and finally, divestiture of a loss-making or non-core business unit. And if you apply any of these investment frameworks to select a stock, then there's a high chance that you will benefit from both ROC expansion, and that will lead to valuation re-rating, and you can get a multi-bagger. This is basically how you get multi-baggers in the stock market, because valuation re-rating is often a key ingredient of multi-bagger stocks. Now let's talk about long-term structural trends. Long-term structural trends are found in industries with a very favorable structure. They are experiencing some form of an industry tailwind, and they are characterized by consistency and predictability of cash flows. They have a long runway for growth, so you have high visibility for many years ahead. And they're also characterized by value migration. So in India, for example, in the last 30 years, you've had value migration from offline to online, from public sector to private sector, from unorganized sector to organized sector. And today there are multiple structural growth plays available in the Indian stock market, namely contract manufacturing, because low-cost manufacturing is in India's DNA, specialty chemicals with critical application, housing finance, fintech, financialization of savings, branded discretionary consumption, renewable energy, multiple long-term structural growth plays are available. So these long-term structural trends, which constitute 70 to 80% of our India fund portfolio, these provide you the long-term compounding. And the shorter-term tactical plays based on variant perception allow you to generate alpha for your clients. So basically, they constitute the other 20-30% of the portfolio.
I like that. I like that notion of the variant perception. So you're really looking at businesses and you're trying to find ways that they've changed or they're at some kind of inflection point that the market doesn't fully appreciate. Does that about sum it up?
Yes, because when the market's perception changes regarding the sustainability of the business, that is when you get the valuation re-rating. See, basically, as a business goes from hopeless to mediocre to good to very good, basically you get multi-baggers along the way because it's all about the trajectory of the return on capital employed. That is what drives valuation re-rating or de-rating over the long run. So, you have to just focus on the business. In which direction is the business going? And is the risk profile of the business getting better or worse? Because that is what will determine the discount rate which investors use to value the business. And that in turn will drive the valuation multiple.
Gotcha. And one of the variant perception scenarios you outlined in the book was this one. I thought this was a great quote. Exceptional capital allocators are systematically mispriced by the markets. I thought that was very interesting. Could you expand on that particular idea?
Well, yes, absolutely. In fact, for exceptional capital allocators, the markets cannot price these businesses fully upfront because what happens is these exceptional capital allocators, especially if they are operating in structural growth industries, they tend to keep pivoting into adjacencies or adjacent areas within their industry, and they keep expanding their terminal value. As a result, these businesses end up being grossly underpriced by the market over the long term. And if you can find such businesses in the small cap or mid cap space with a large size of opportunity and with sector leadership, then be the most patient with such investments. In the second book, I've actually written this that different stocks require varying degrees of patience. So basically, for certain kinds of businesses, you can be less patient. But if you find these kind of businesses, then you should be very, very patient with them because these embedded optionalities can't be priced by the market. Businesses led by dynamic managements tend to keep springing positive surprises. And because of that, they keep expanding the terminal value. And you cannot model that in an Excel spreadsheet.
Absolutely. And you also wrote about your investment philosophy. You said, for many years, I primarily invested in microcaps, small caps, and cyclicals. And now you seem to have moved to focus on higher quality stocks that can compound over time. So why did that shift take place? And what are kind of the advantages and disadvantages of both approaches?
I think when you're investing in a statistically cheap security of a bad quality business, then during an industry upcycle or during a market upcycle driven by liquidity, you will make a lot of paper profit. But once the going gets tough and the economic conditions worsen, then these businesses will start incurring losses, their earnings simply collapse, and you end up with permanent loss of capital. But if you invest in a very high quality, strong business, which is enjoying sectoral leadership, then as I've written in this book, those managements tend to capture market share from their weakened competition during bear markets and economic slowdowns, and they end up becoming stronger with each passing crisis. And this market share capture is a source of great value creation for shareholders over time. So this was a big learning for me from this long bear market in India that you can make temporary paper profits by investing in a poor quality business during a bull market, but sustainable long-term wealth is made only by investing in quality businesses with healthy growth. Now, why do I say healthy growth? You don't have to aim for hyper growth, because any business which is targeting hyper growth with a return on capital which is below its cost of capital will eventually destroy shareholder value, even though the stock price may temporarily surge during a bull market. But long-term sustainable wealth is created only by focusing on the quality of the earnings of the business and the durability of growth of that particular company. This 27-month-long bear market from January 2018 to March 2020 ingrained in my mind the significance of resilience and longevity, which are the key to compounding. And this bear market brought about a profound shift in my thought process as an investor. Henceforth, I would focus on return of capital before return on capital. Capital preservation and a focus on quality would take precedence for me henceforth. And this is where the title of the book, The Making of a Value Investor, actually comes from, because this book covers the journey of my evolution as an investor during that bear market and my reflections and learnings along the way.
Yeah, I've come to a pretty similar conclusion. Like, I feel like when you're investing in more speculative situations like a highly cyclical small cap, you really have to time the cycle right. And I think that's very difficult to do. So I would rather have companies that can perform well over an entire economic cycle.
Correct. That is how sustainable wealth is made in the long run.
Yeah. So your new book is an investment journal. So let's talk about journaling a little bit. So you wrote that you spent $10 on a journal in 2014 and you consider it one of your best investments. So what are the chief advantages of journaling?
I think the habit of journaling has helped me a lot in learning about myself and improving both as an investor and as an individual. I receive a lot of valuable feedback and I use it to correct my personal biases. I've also maintained a personal archive of the media commentary and investor behavior during various episodes of market panic over the last 9 years. And I find that it is highly beneficial to refer to this information whenever the market undergoes its periodic steep corrections, because human behavior in the markets has not really changed much over time. And because I document my investment decisions and subsequent developments in a journal, it helps me avoid hindsight bias, because you cannot look at your own writing and deny that, you know, this is how you were thinking in the past. That's again something where the journal comes in really very handy. And there's one more very, very important point which I would like to make here, that journaling as a practice is something which all investors should follow, because all investors make mistakes, but the great investors tend to repeat old mistakes less often. And by having your investment journey with you in your journal, in which you've actually documented all your past mistakes, you will obviously not repeat the same mistake twice. So new mistakes will keep on happening. That's understandable, but avoid repeating the old mistakes. That is how you improve as an investor.
Yeah, absolutely. I found that with journaling, I often look back at things I wrote and I remember them much differently than how they actually occurred. And I think the journal helps correct those kind of blinders that you might have in your memory. Great. So this book was primarily about a bear market from 2018 to 2020 in India. So the Indian stock market rose 36% in 2017, declined by 18% from the highs in 2018, and then had a max drawdown of 35% by the depths of COVID. Now that's at the index level. Within the index, the damage was much more widespread than that and deeper. You wrote 56% of stocks had a peak to trough decline in excess of 70%. So that's a pretty brutal thing to go through. So what were some of the chief lessons that you feel that you drew from this drawdown and in the bull market previously?
Sure. So before I talk about the key learnings from that particular bear market, I would just like to also, you know, further emphasize on the amount of pain which investors had to go through in that particular period. So, you know, after the roaring bull run in mid-cap and small-cap stocks in India between 2014 and 2017, investors were in for a very nasty shock, because the gut-wrenching bear market that began in mid-cap and small-cap stocks from January 2018 lasted an agonizing 27 months. And it concluded with the COVID-19 market crash of March 2020. By the time the bear market ended, there was a widespread sense of utter hopelessness among most investors, as the mid-cap indices in India collapsed more than 45% from the January 2018 high. And the small cap index in India over those 27 months collapsed 55% from their all-time high in January 2018. And thousands of listed stocks in India crashed more than 60 to 80% during this particular period. And panic in the market started being witnessed from June 2018. That is where this book begins from. Now, about this the big learnings from that bear market. This book is dedicated to all my investor friends and colleagues, because without their helpful feedback and guidance and constant moral support, I would have not been able to do as well as I did during that particular bear market. I was able to survive that bear market only because of them. And there were certain pieces of wisdom from them which I received, which I've shared in this book as well. And I would like to share those pieces of wisdom with all of you right now. The first advice which they gave me was that if you want to make it big as an investor in the stock market, you need to be detached from stock price fluctuations, because during bear markets, it becomes extremely tough to endure such severe notional losses. The second piece of advice and learning from them was that India will grow at a healthy rate. The large cap indices stocks may have earnings growth of low double digits, but there will be a few small cap and mid cap stocks in every kind of market which are poised to grow earnings per share at 25 to 30% over the next 3 to 5 years. And they are bound to create wealth for you in the long run. All that you need to have is the confidence and the conviction to back them. In the long run, what ultimately counts is earnings, earnings, earnings. Third very important piece of advice from them, that sanity will eventually prevail after every bear market or market crash, just like it always has done in history. And number four, and very important, have belief and conviction in the power of India, its entrepreneurs, and its business ecosystem. This will what will help you stay the course during bear markets and periodic severe corrections.
Thanks for sharing that. And on the first point where you said you need to be detached from stock price fluctuations, what are some of the methods that you use to stay detached and to try to keep a level head while, prices are going crazy?
One of the best ways to be detached is to avoid looking at stock prices as much as possible. I just look at stock prices once in the whole day, in the beginning of the market opening or after the market close. So I just try to insulate myself from the noise as much as I can and avoid looking at stock prices. Also, one very good way to basically develop the detachment is to be an ardent student of financial market history. Because if you, like, for example, when I look back at the last 30 years of the Indian stock market and what stock prices of good quality businesses eventually did after every bear market, in almost every case, those stock prices rose back to all-time highs after the bear market got over. And 30 years is not a short period of time. You have got documented data with you, empirical evidence, which shows that in a market crash, both quality and junk stock prices fall. Quality eventually rises again, whereas junk never recovers. Junk only starts rising again when the next bull run takes over after many years. So, being invested in quality businesses not only helps you minimize drawdowns, it also helps you recover back to all-time highs after a bear market. And how much you're able to retain after the recovery from a bear market is far more important than how much paper profits you make by investing in stocks of bad quality businesses during a bull market.
Now, you mentioned staying away from the junk. So, what are some of characteristics of kind of junk stocks that you would want to avoid?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, basically, deep cyclicals, commodities, which are operating at peak operating margins compared to their historical averages. Then you have got highly indebted companies, loss-making tech stocks in the US, for example. You saw what happened to. So, if Apple, Google, Microsoft fell 30% in 2022, the junk quality loss-making tech stocks fell 70% in 2022. So basically, this is why, in a period of rising interest rates, value investing always outperforms, because value stocks by definition already have current earnings, they have near-term earnings, and the long duration stocks in which the earnings are expected to come after many years down the line, those are the stocks which get decimated in a period of rising interest rates. So if this higher for longer narrative actually prevails and actually, does occur, then those kind of long duration stocks will have a tough time going forward. Right now, the market is expecting the Fed to cut interest rates, and that's why you're again seeing speculation building up. But if inflation becomes entrenched and remains high, and because of which, if interest rates remain high, then you'll again see a sell-off in these long duration stocks, whereas value stocks will start outperforming.
Interesting. And you've also mentioned, you mentioned earlier how you have a belief in the growth prospects and the power of India. So why is India a very attractive area for investment right now?
Well, again, India today stands at a big inflection point, which I've talked about in many of my past interviews as well, but I'll share them again here. So if you look at the financial market history of US, Japan, and China, and observe what happened to their stock markets when their GDP doubled from $3 trillion to $6 trillion, their stock markets did not just double in that period. Their stock markets tripled or even quadrupled in that journey. Why? Because as a nation transitions from a low per capita income country to a middle income per capita country, your basic spending on items like food does not go up much. But with the surplus savings which you have now, the categories of financialization of savings and branded discretionary consumption, these two categories simply explode. Just to give you some numbers here, in the last 3.5 years, the domestic investment by retail investors in India through domestic equity mutual funds has quadrupled from $500 million per month to $2 billion per month. So the financialization of savings aspect is already playing out in front of our eyes. Today, India stands at $3.4 trillion of GDP. And over the last few years, as India began their journey from $3 trillion onwards, you're already seeing this aspect of financialization of savings taking place. Along with this, you see which are the stocks between brand, in the branded discretionary consumption space, which have created a lot of wealth. It is those stocks which are catering to the aspirational middle class of India. So basically, this aspirational consumption is really taking off in a very big way in the Indian market right now. And this is why you have to position your portfolio in these two categories, along with the other industries where there's a lot of government thrust. Because I always tell people, always follow the money, where the money is pouring in. So basically, that is where you'll get the maximum growth. So infrastructure, renewable energy, because of energy transition, and these two categories of financialization of savings and branded discretionary consumption, I think these will create a lot of wealth over the next decade. And if we simply assume that over the next 20 years, market cap to GDP in India approximates one over time, one can just envisage the kind of wealth creation that lies in store for investors in the great businesses in India. Trillions of dollars, because who will capture the bulk of this upcoming market cap wealth creation boom in India? The nation's best managed businesses with proven ability to scale up their operations and capture market share. Those are the businesses which will actually become stronger over time and benefit the most from this upcoming economic golden period for the Indian market.
What are some of those great businesses that you think will benefit long term from this trend?
I think within financialization of savings, I'll just talk about a few stocks that we hold in our India fund as well. So we
Sure.
hold Nuvama Wealth Management. It's a leading wealth management company in India, which basically distributes these different financial products like life insurance, general insurance, and mutual funds and various structured products. I think as financial literacy keeps going up, then a lot of money will start getting diverted away from bank savings accounts towards the capital markets, and this company will be a direct beneficiary of that particular trend. And the branded discretionary consumption, you have got this branded footwear retailers like Metro Brands. You have got branded wedding apparel retailers like Vedant Fashions, which are case catering to the aspirational middle class of India. I mean, they will benefit greatly. And across various categories in India, be it appliances or basic consumption items like food and staples, there is so much mass consumption of unbranded, unorganized sector items today. So as this shift from unorganized to organized plays out over the next 20 years because of stricter compliance norms and regulatory norms, because of that, the listed players which operate in the organized sector, they'll tend to benefit disproportionately. So just, be on the right side of the industry cycle. This is again something which I've talked about in my second book as well, that you may be a great investor, but if you invest in a business with headwinds for the next few years, then however cheap you buy the stock at, it's very difficult to make money in the short run over the next few years, because the market likes to focused on those businesses which are experiencing tailwind. There has to be a tailwind or some kind of an inflection point in the industry because of which earnings growth will grow very fast. That is the kind of stocks which investors like to invest in, because India is a growth market. India is not a market where you should invest for 10% growth. India is a market where you have to look for opportunities of businesses which can grow their earnings per share at 20 to 25% over the next 3 to 5 years. That is how that emerging market risk premium will be justified.
Interesting. And do you think there are any businesses based in the United States that might benefit from the growth of India?
Well, I don't know. So 100% of my personal equity allocation is in my India fund only. So it's all Indian stock market focus. So I'm not really tracking the US stock markets anymore. So I don't really have an answer to that question right now.
Gotcha. Yeah, no problem. So I thought that this quote really resonated with me. If you worry about global macro factors all the time, there will always be something for you to worry about. So why is that that's such a common trap? I found it in my own experience. And what are some of the best ways to avoid that trap?
I think the best way to avoid a trap is to realize that the biggest risk in investing and the markets in general is the risk which no one is talking about. So if you're thinking about the risk which everyone is talking about on social media or on news channels, then you're already way behind the curve because markets already have priced that in. The biggest risk which will markets fall on unexpected bad news, not on expected bad news. So for example, today, no one has been thinking about the possibility, and the possibility is very remote. That, for instance, that Iran and US will go into a direct conflict with each other because of the Middle East situation, or that China will attack Taiwan, in the next 12 months, because of which you may have World War III. Because, and similarly, COVID-19 was an unexpected event. So if something is unexpected or very remote in possibility, and if that happens, that is when markets react. And that is why you should not spend too much time thinking about the daily problems with the world and with the economy in general. Good businesses led by good managements navigate across these different economic cycles and they create wealth for you on the other side. So just hang on, because buying a good business is not that difficult. Finding a good stock idea is not that difficult in today's digital age. Holding on to it amid all the noise, that is what is difficult for most investors. So focus on the business and the underlying industry developments, because that is all that really you can control, your personal behavior and your research process. There's nothing else in our control as investors, and we have to accept this reality and always be humble.
Absolutely. And on that note, like you also wrote that you shouldn't sell a great business, even if it becomes temporarily overvalued. So how do you have the conviction to do that? Like even if a stock might get a little bit overvalued and you think it's a great company, I agree with you that for long-term compounding, you need to hold on to it. So how do you go through that thought process?
That's a very important question. And in the book, I've actually written this, that this is a very important lesson for me in my investing journey, that if it is a good quality business with high growth prospects for a long period of time, then it is okay to pay a high P multiple and sacrifice the first year return. The returns from the second to fifth years will compensate for the flat return in the first year. And why does that happen? It is because for businesses that will grow their earnings even at a moderate pace, but for a very long time, the optically high P multiples that deter many value investors in reality are pretty low. This means that if you buy a strongly moated business at what appears to be a full price based on current year earnings, you will still end up compounding your money at a higher rate than the discount rate you used to arrive at that fair price. The longer the competitive advantage period for a business, the more likely it is worth a lot more than what the market thinks. Durability of the moat is the key factor. The market tends to underappreciate companies that have really strong moats because the durability often allows for the company's runway to last longer than many expect. So for long-term investing, the focus should be shifted away from entry P multiples to duration of the competitive advantage period. Now, I mentioned a term called a full price based on current year earnings, which basically is another way of rephrasing a fair valuation or a reasonable valuation. And how do we understand what is the justified valuation or fair valuation for any business in the world, in any stock market? So this is something which is of a mystery to many people. So I would like to clarify this myth once and for all for everyone. Just read two white papers First white paper is called What Does the Price to Earning Multiple Mean by Michael Morbison. The second white paper is titled The P Ratio, A User's Manual by Epoch Investment Partners. Once you read these two white papers, you will understand what should be the justified or fair P multiple for any listed business based on the interplay between the return on invested capital and the growth of the business. Okay. Once you know the justified valuation multiple for a business, if you are able to buy it below that multiple, then over time you'll benefit from earnings growth and also valuation re-rating. And if you buy a business at above that fair P multiple, then over time you'll benefit from earnings growth, but you also may get some valuation de-rating. So this is, as clear as I can explain, this enigma or mystery, around P multiples and valuation, just demystified once and for all. Just read these two white papers. You will know what is a justified P multiple and what is the fair P multiple for any business based on the interplay between ROIC growth and the expected durability and sustainability of that growth.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for those suggestions. We'll definitely check those out. And in the same vein, you talked about how investors should focus on the things that are within their control and less on things that are not in their control. So, what are some of the key things under an investor's control that they should focus on?
Investors should focus on developing patience and a long-term mindset. In addition to your research process and your personal behavior, all develop this habit of being patient with your investments, because businesses are not built in an Excel spreadsheet. Often in the second book I've talked about this, that often we investors tend to be too harsh on managements who actually have to go through the grind of building a business in the real world. Unlike us investors, they cannot just bail out when the going gets tough. So be patient with managements who are just trying their best to manage the business to the best of their abilities. And at the same time, even though it pays to have a long-term view, but a long-term investment horizon must also be married with an investment process willing to continually question the core investment thesis. So investors should ex exercise active patience, that is diligently verifying their original investment thesis and doing nothing until something materially adverse or negative emerges. Investors tend to become complacent and stop questioning their existing holdings when their stock prices are going up, and they resume analyzing in detail only when the prices start falling. Don't analyze your holdings only when they fall. Just because the stock price of an existing holding is going up doesn't necessarily mean that nothing negative is happening in its business. So be a business analyst, not a securities analyst.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, focus on the business and then focus on the price seems like to be the key takeaway there.
Correct.
Great. So in the book, you also, there's a big part of it is the COVID crash. So I thought based on your writings that you remained remarkably cool during that period. So how did you kind of manage that and manage to, stay calm during that event?
So I remember this journal entry from 23rd March 2020, which is there in the book as well, that I've written there that unlike the previous cases of 2018 to 2019 of market falls, when I used to feel very nervous and anxious, this time I know that I'm in the safe hands of quality, that my portfolio's eventual recovery is a matter of when, not if. So by the time that bear market ended on 23rd March 2020, because I transitioned over to becoming a quality investor focused on high quality businesses and prudent diversification, now I was able to face the bear market with far more calm and a lot of equanimity. Because when you're invested in businesses which have a shaky foundation, then you also will become shaky and nervous during the market falls. But it's only when you're in the safe hands of quality that you can sustain and endure during those market falls. So even though my personal portfolio fell more than 30-35% in just 1 month in March 2020, I was able, basically in between 2018 and 2019, by the end of 2019, I had recovered back to where I was at the beginning of January 2018. But in March 2020, when my portfolio just fell off a cliff, even then I was less perturbed and I was far more calm and confident that this time I will make a strong comeback. Because unlike the past, this time my portfolio is not on a shaky ground. It is built up of very strong businesses led by capable managements, and this too shall pass. I think this is, the confidence which you can get only when you're invested in a high quality portfolio. And this is also why in 2022, technology crash in US, when stocks of high quality stock, stock prices of high quality businesses like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon fell, many long-term investors in those businesses were able to hang on because of the underlying quality of these companies. Whereas if you were invested in loss-making tech companies, it would have been very difficult for you to maintain the conviction to hold on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I owned many low quality businesses during that event, and that made it very difficult to hold. And after that experience, I thought, I really need to focus more on higher quality businesses. So the next time there's an event like this, it's much easier to manage. So, in that same way of thinking, you've talked about stress adjusted returns. So, the importance of not just high returns, but good stress adjusted returns. So, what are some of the techniques that you use to kind of maximize your stress-adjusted return?
Twofold strategy again, focus on quality and prudent diversification. If you follow these two mantras, you definitely will maximize your stress-adjusted returns. In fact, there's an entry in the book from 2018 where I mentioned that I was reviewing my contract notes and trade reports of the previous 5 years, and I realized that if I'd simply stayed put with the stocks of these high-quality businesses which I'd bought 5 years ago, then I would have made the same return which I made over the previous 5 years, jumping in and out of so many lower quality stocks. In both the cases, the returns end result were the same. But because of so much active management, it had an effect on my personal and social life because so much time got wasted. So stress-adjusted returns matter a lot. They really do. But by the time most of us investors realize this, we have exhausted many years of our investing life and greatly weakened our mental health. So like the saying goes, old too soon, wise too late. I hope people read my book and avoid the mistake which I did in the past.
Yeah, there's so many great lessons within there. So another thing you focused on a lot about was risk management. And you wrote that risk management is more important than high returns. So why is that the case? Why is risk management more important than simply the return rate?
So in bull markets, we often tend to mistake high returns for high intelligence, but that is not the case. Especially when you're invested with a fund manager or with some investment advisory service, check how much risk they took on to generate those returns in a bull market. Because if the portfolio is made up of very risky speculative stocks, then that may lead to a great drawdown during the next bear market. So the capital preservation is very, very important. And why do I emphasize this concept of prudent diversification so much? It's because however well you are prepared and have calculated your odds, risk surfaces from places you can never imagine. Even if you're very careful in crossing the road by looking left and right, a drone might still kill you from above. And things can go wrong in ways you never thought of. And your only defense against an unknown future is prudent diversification, a portfolio of 20 to 25 stocks diversified across industries and risk factors. This practice ensures against a catastrophic outcome for the portfolio as a whole, and it also opens the door to optionality. You have to understand that in investing, the basic raw material is money. That is, in other words, in order to make money, you need to have money and protect your money. And you can only do that if you can survive the bear markets in the future. So, capital preservation should be your first priority at all times. In fact, even Benjamin Graham, when he invested, when he defined an investment operation, in that definition, if you read it, you'll notice that he has placed return of capital before return on capital in that particular definition. So even the father of value investing understood the significance and the importance of prioritizing safety of capital above all else.
Interesting. So yeah, so you think of the ideal portfolio somewhere between 20 to 25 stocks, diversified among industries and high quality businesses. Now you also wrote that you don't want excessive diversification. So you wrote that, for instance, you now avoid low conviction stocks where you have a 1 or 2% position. So why is that the case? Why should you avoid too much diversification and avoid those kind of low conviction ideas?
I'll explain with the help of a mathematical example. So let's assume that you put 1% allocation in a stock. Even if that stock goes up 10 times, even if it goes up 900%, the overall impact on your portfolio will be just 9%. So basically, when you find those truly great ideas, you have to bet big. Now, I understand when you're managing public money, you have certain restrictions and you have to, you cannot go above a certain threshold when you're managing public money. For example, in my India fund, I try to cap individual stock exposures at 15% and individual sector level exposures at 30%. And I initiate new positions in my India fund portfolio with a weighting of 3 to 5%. Sometimes I come across an exceptionally high, high risk reward opportunity, like a special situation. In those cases, I go up to as high as 9 to 10%. But I think allocation is equally, if not more important than stock selection. I've stopped allocating, this 0.5%, 1%, to these kinds of bets in my portfolio, because even if because they just do not move the needle. And you have to back up the truck in your high conviction ideas and try to focus on allocation. This is something which all experienced investors attest to after their portfolio reaches a certain size. So once you become rich through investing, after that you realize that, okay, it was 20% of your picks which led to 80% of your wealth creation. And that happened because you let those winners run and become bigger part of your portfolio over time.
Yeah, I think Warren Buffett recently said that he attributes a lot of Berkshire's performance to only 12 investment decisions throughout the course of the company. So it's definitely a testament to that whole idea. So within this bear, the boom that you experienced from 2014 through 2017, and then the bust from 2018 to 2020, and then the recovery, what has this taught you about the idea of Mr. Market and market sentiment?
Well, like I read in my book as well, that fundamentals don't decide the price for a stock at a given point of time. Demand and supply do. And that in turn is driven by prevailing investor sentiment. And there are two ways to judge the prevailing investor sentiment in the market. The first one is through the initial public offerings or the IPO market. They are an effective indicator of market sentiment. There are three stages of the IPO market. So during stage one, good companies come out with IPOs at reasonable valuations. During stage two, good companies come out with IPOs at expensive valuations. And during stage three, bad companies, many of which do not even have any earnings, come out with IPOs at ludicrous valuations and still are heavily oversubscribed by retail investors, whose surging presence in the markets is a late cycle indicator. Very high levels of margin funding in the primary and secondary markets are a predominant characteristic of the final blowout phase of a bull market. The second way to gauge prevailing market psychology is through the quality of investor portfolios. So, as a bull market matures, many investors tend to move their portfolios from high quality stocks with steady growth and high return on equity to cheaper but high growth stocks with poor management quality and inferior return ratios. Then they move to commodity and cyclicals. Then they move to turnaround situations that are currently loss-making, then to macro caps with limited track record of operations, and finally to highly leveraged companies with projections of rapid revenue growth. At this point, the bull market usually tops out, and at the end of the euphoric phase, most investor portfolios have only junk stocks left in them. During the bear market that follows, both quality and junk stocks fall hard. Quality eventually bounces back in the subsequent recovery, whereas the junk stocks stay low for many years until the next bull run takes over. And it is only after going through the pain of a couple of such cycles can an investor resist the incessant urge to move down the quality ladder and chase quicker returns in bull markets. So I think this is why Warren Buffett has taught us that we don't have to be more smarter than the rest. We just have to be more disciplined than the rest. It's all about temperament, temperament, temperament.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on today and sharing so much wisdom. For my last question, if you were to talk to someone who was new to value investing and wanted some advice, what would you say to them?
I think the three pieces of advice, which value investing is all about, is already encapsulated in The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham. Number one, think of stocks as part ownership in a business. Number two, make Mr. Market your servant and, use Mr. Market's manic mood swings to sell stocks at high valuations and buy stocks at lower valuations. And number three, always insist on having a margin of safety with regards to valuations when you're investing. The fourth piece, which I would like to add, is from Buffett. It's about the circle of competence. Very, very important. Always invest only in businesses that you can understand well, because that will what will help you stay the course during the periodic severe market corrections.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. If someone wants to learn more about you and read your content, what are some of the best ways to do that?
So I can be reached on LinkedIn and Twitter to purchase either of my two books, The Joys of Compounding or The Making of a Value Investor. You can visit amazon.com. And to learn more about Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund, you can visit stellarwealthindia.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more information, please go to securityanalysis.org. Subscribers to the website get early ad-free access to podcast episodes in addition to weekly in-depth profiles of companies.